May it please the court. Michael Cheeks is in prison today because the prosecution's key witness against him lied, and the state of Illinois knew it. Even before trial, the witness, Mr. Cheeks' ex-girlfriend, Maria Brown, made her intentions known in a letter to Mr. Cheeks. She said, "I have to make sure that you get held responsible for his death now instead of me." And as the only eyewitness in the case, she said she could make sure this happened because, quote, "In this case, the only thing that matters is what I say." Brown went through with her plan, and she falsely testified at trial that Mr. Cheeks did not live in the house that they shared. This led directly to his home invasion conviction, and it made his claim of self-defense unavailable as to the murder charges.
Well, let me ask you this. It was leased in her name. The house or the apartment was leased in her
name?
Yes,
it was the house.
And that there's no question that that particular night or day, she informed him through her mother not to come into the house, right?
There was evidence to that effect presented at trial, yes.
I don't think that's disputed, is it?
No.
So here we have an individual who's not on the lease, who is told don't come in the house. Now, doesn't that change the nature of what you're arguing, that they lived together and had children together and so forth?
Your Honor, under Illinois law, it does not make a difference, and this is why. There, one case that we cited in the briefs is Illinois versus De La Cruz. That case, the defendant was not on a lease, had lost his set of keys, had been kicked out of the house months before. The girlfriend said, "Stop coming here, stop coming around this house." But then when she testified at trial, she was honest, and the prosecutor asked if he still lived there, and she said, "Yes, I couldn't get him to leave." In that case, the court reversed the conviction for home invasion because there was insufficient evidence that wasn't his dwelling place. Now, the history of this law may shine some light on this. Illinois versus Reed, a case by the Illinois Supreme Court, there the court looked at the history of the statute and said, this is not about domestic dispute. This is, you know, in that case, the defendant had been prohibited by a court from entering the house, an order of the court. And the court said, he still had an interest in dwelling there, even though the court had forbidden it, and they said there was insufficient evidence to convict him of home invasion. Here, the only difference between these cases and Mr. Cheek's case is Ms. Brown's false testimony. Otherwise, there would have been insufficient evidence. So I think it's clear that there was the home invasion conviction was based on her false testimony, but the self-defense as to the murder was also made unavailable. Now, after trial, Brown explained herself, and she wrote more letters to Mr. Cheeks, and she said, quote, "I didn't want you to go free. I wanted you to go to jail for my own personal reasons. And who knows? Maybe if I'd told the truth about you living there, you wouldn't have so much time. But I seen a way to get you out of my life, and I took it." And quote, "Oh, and no hard feelings about you not living there. You see, I wanted you to go to jail. And if I'd actually let someone know that you was living there, you may not have went. At least that is what was advised of me the very first night."
If I could, please go ahead. If I could interrupt, I'm still having trouble seeing how this affects the murder conviction.
Under Illinois law, Your Honor, the justification of self-defense is not available to someone who is deemed an aggressor. Mm-hmm. And someone who uses force during the commission of a forcible felony, such as home invasion, is an aggressor. And in this case, we know we don't have the trial record, is not part of the record on appeal, but we know that this trial court found that Mr. Cheeks was guilty of home invasion and then said that the defense of self-defense was unavailable. So the only requirement that Mr. Cheeks must show here is that there's any reasonable likelihood that the false testimony could have affected the judgment of the fact finder. This is, as the Supreme Court explained in United States versus Augers and NAPU versus Illinois, this standard is easier to meet. It's more liberal than a Brady materiality standard or a Strickland prejudice standard. And the reason is, if a state obtains a conviction based on false testimony, that's fundamentally unfair, in the words of the court. And the tainted conviction offends the very concept of ordered liberty.
Wasn't he convicted of the felony murder and then just straight murder? Or am I
It appears that he was convicted of both, yes.
Right. So now the straight-up murder conviction, the argument you're making with respect to the felony conviction would not apply. So are you saying he couldn't use self-defense in the straight murder conviction either?
That's right,
Your Honor. As well as the home
invasion. That's right, Your Honor. And that's and the trial court said, once again, we don't have the full transcript, but we know the trial court said that self-defense as to the entire case was unavailable. So there is at least a reasonable likelihood that the false testimony could have affected the judgment. And because it's so clear in this case, I think it's not a surprise that respondent conceded this point in the district court. And his belated attempts here before this court to resurrect the issue through the concurrent sentence doctrine should not be considered by this court.
Can we go back to that quote that you made in response to a question that Judge Ripple had? If I had actually let someone know in the letter, does that undermine the argument that the prosecution knowingly put on false testimony?
Your Honor, first I would emphasize again this isn't a sufficiency of the evidence standard. But looking at that letter, I think that it does not undermine that. If we consider that Ms. Brown was advised the night of the incident that she should testify somewhat or else Mr. Cheeks would not go to jail. And then she goes ahead and testifies in accordance with that advice. I think it's sort of disingenuous for the state to say, you know, we didn't know.
Well, of course, it's not identified who gave her that advice, assuming that what she said is true.
It's not
whether it was a police officer or prosecutor, that is not in the record, correct?
That's not. The letter does not say who advised her. In the record, it does show that she was taken to the police station that night and that she talked to a police officer. That's the only person in the record that we know she talked to that night. And her choice of the word advised, I think, indicates that it wasn't her child or someone else around there. It was someone that she thought knew something about this issue and she tied it to the length of his sentence. Now, who could have known something like that but the police officer, and who would she have trusted? I see that my rebuttal light is on. If there are no questions at this time, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you. We'll hear now from Mr. Benton.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. Before I get started on the main point of my argument, I'd like to take just a second to correct a couple of things that counsel said. First of all, she cited a case that she said was awfully similar, People versus De La Cruz, in terms of what the home invasion statute does. De La Cruz, our belief is not similar and can easily be differentiated. In People v. De La Cruz, when asked whether or not the person who was in the house was still living in the house, the complainant said specifically, yes, he was in the house, I couldn't get him out. And in fact, home invasion was the only charge at that time. This is different. She didn't say, yes, he was in the house. Second of all, I'd like to take issue with the fact that counsel mentioned and put in a brief that we've conceded any points. We didn't concede any points in terms of what was argued. Petitioner, when he filed his petition, had a one-sentence description. And in fact, we answered, we notified the district court that one-sentence description cannot possibly meet the standards that the rules governing habeas procedures under Rule 2C said. And then after that, because this court has always said that parties should liberally construe a pro se petitioner's habeas answer, we did that. Finally, in terms of advice, she said he was advised, and that clearly shows the state knew of something. That's just not true. There's no mention in terms of what was told to her, who was told to her, and what kind of relevance it was to the claim. There has been no showing that Maria Brown lied to the judge who was the trier of fact at trial. Brown testified she petitioner didn't have keys or was on the lease, that on August 30th she ordered the petitioner to leave the house. On the very next day he moved back without permission. He subsequently moved himself back into the house, and in her opinion, she did not consider him living at the house. Nothing in the two post-trial letters contradict that testimony. The appellate court reasonably found those letters cumulative to the one that she sent before trial. Like the post-trial letters, That letter, that first letter, made so-called threats that if I can get anything done, and implied the house was the petitioner's home on the night of the murder. And most importantly, she was thoroughly cross-examined about that letter. This court has always said one of the key points in looking at a perjury complaint is whether or not the petitioner whether there was a chance to cross-examine the witness. Any inconsistency went to whether the petitioner resided at the house. The only convictions that exist at this time are twofold: intentional murder and home invasion. Home invasion is not a predicate for intentional murder. Whether the petitioner lived at the house has no relationship to the intentional murder. And nothing contradicts the heart of her testimony, the events in the house involving the intentional murder of Derek Peterson.
But the self-defense is unavailable. It is unavailable in Illinois to justify use of force by an aggressor or an initial aggressor.
But the fact is, petitioner complains in her brief, in his brief, that he was the initial aggressor, and whether or not he was the initial aggressor is an issue that needs to be viewed. There's no evidence to rebut that. There's no evidence to rebut the fact that the petitioner was not told to come to the house. There's no evidence to rebut the fact that he did not have permission to be there. He showed up after midnight to a locked home. He snuck in through a kitchen window. And once in the house, he started choking Maria Brown. He told her, "I'm going to kill you." He grabbed a knife. He threatened the victim. He chased the fleeing victim around the house. After stabbing him, pushed him to the floor. Under 2254E1, those facts are all presumed correct. They have not been rebutted. Further, and importantly, there's not been any showing the state knew or should have known of any type of alleged perjury, and the burden is squarely falls on the petitioner.
I can interrupt there. I suppose we disagree with you on a perjured testimony issue. Suppose. What do we do about this knowingly question?
About
the question of whether or not the government knowingly used the information.
I think it's plain that there is no evidence that the government knew anything.
Is it fully litigated below, or do we have to send that back to the district court?
I don't think it was not litigated below, but it certainly doesn't have to be sent back, because it's the burden of the petitioner to show that the government knew, and she's made no showing. There's no reason for the state to believe that Brown was lying, since she conceded at cross-examination at trial. The petitioner moved himself back into the house. She didn't have the police evict him. She had been at the house he had been at the house on the morning of the murder. He kept a car there and let her use it, and he kept clothes at the house. That's all before the trier of fact.
Of course, we don't have the trial transcript.
Your Honor, I don't believe
so. Verify that was her testimony.
We can verify it was a testimony, because that was the testimony cited by the appellate court, whose facts are correct.
Right, I know the appellate court cited it, but they didn't have the record either, did they?
State appellate court certainly would have had the transcript of the trial.
The district court didn't have it when it reviewed it, correct?
No, the district court did not have it. But the district court, through the facts found by the appellate court, which are found to be correct unless rebutted, and all of the points I've made are within the Illinois appellate court's findings. This court must give deference to a state court decision that is minimally consistent with the evidence and to a state court's resolution of any ambiguity. The state court's holding here was not an unreasonable determination in light of the evidence. In sum, all of the questions relating to any alleged...
Let me just go back just a minute. Normally when this court or the federal court makes that determination, we do look at the transcripts to also look at the underlying findings by the state court. Normally, the transcripts are provided of the trial.
Well, yes, Your Honor, but Rule 5 also gives the district court a great deal of discretion whether or not to what transcripts needed. And this district court, in fact, decided it needed transcripts and ordered the respondent to give them. In fact, in Simontal case of this court's 2 years ago, the court specifically said that transcripts are actually very rare and not often used by the habeas courts. In sum, all of the questions relating to any alleged perjury go to whether the petitioner resided at the house and the count of home invasion. None of the alleged perjuries go to actions in the house and the count of intentional murder. None. There is no evidence that the perjury had any connection, even if it was perjury, which we dispute it was, it had any connection with the intentional murder at all. Moreover, the petitioner offers no proof that the state knowingly used perjury, something it must show to gain relief.
Now, I want to go back to this transcript question, because I know it's not a requirement that the court look at the trial transcripts, but in light of the allegations that were made here, it's hard for me to understand why the trial testimony would not be reviewed in addition to the post-conviction testimony.
Well, Your Honor, again, that's up to the discretion of the district court, and the district court had before it all of the facts as found by the appellate court, facts that are deemed correct unless rebutted. It also had the transcripts of all of the post-collateral matters, not only the transcripts of what Mabria Brown testified to, but the court's reasoning, and the court's reasoning included citing the state transcripts. Again, I'm not arguing with the court that the court, in fact, may or may not want transcripts. The fact is Rule 5 gives the district courts discretion. And this court, in fact, has said in case law that transcripts are rare and that the discretion under Rule 5 certainly should be with the district court.
Well, I just guess here's why I'm concerned, because the district court ruled on the reasonableness of the state's court finding that Brown testified the same at trial and at the 2-1401 hearing and didn't have the transcript. I realize the district court was just relying on what the state court had found, but you know, this might have been a situation where having the transcript could have been helpful.
Well, I mean,
that's my only point.
Again, not only is none of the to conclude any of the perjury goes to the all it go it only goes to the home invasion. None of it goes to the intentional murder. Moreover, the petitioner offers no proof that the state knowingly used perjury testimony. Thus, the petitioner has not met his specific burden that he is entitled to habeas relief, and this court should affirm the judgment of the district court. If the court has no further questions, thank you.
Thank you, sir. How much time is Ms. Mace at? 3 minutes. Ms. Mace, I'd like your view as to what we ought to do with respect to the knowingly issue. Should we agree with you on the question of perjured testimony? What do we do about whether the state knowingly used such testimony?
You should grant the habeas petition, Your Honor.
You feel it was fully litigated below?
No, it was not litigated, and that was respondent's choice. Mr. Cheeks filed his petition, and then the district court ordered respondent to file an answer, and respondent did so, but only, you know, laid out all three elements of the claim and only chose to respond to one. Under Rule 8 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, any averments in a pleading to which a response of pleading is required, as one here, are admitted when not denied in the response of pleading. Now, this court in Lewis v. Stearns, there was a situation that was sort of similar, and the respondent just asked to amend the answer once they discovered there were other issues. They didn't do so here. Admitted in the brief to this court, he says, we didn't file a motion to request that we file a surreply or an amended answer. This issue was waived, and so it wasn't litigated, and so no evidence was presented to the court, and the court never ruled on it. I also want to respond to the suggestion that there's no contradiction in the testimony. We don't have the record or the trial transcript, but what we do know is from citations by other courts. We know that Brown testified at trial that Mr. Cheeks did not live in the house, did not have permission to be in the house, that, quote, it wasn't his house, and that she, quote, considered him not living at the house, end quote. And we know in the post-conviction testimony, she testified that she, quote, just let him come and go as he pleased, end quote. She considered him living there on a part-time basis. Now, to suggest that there's something else in this trial transcript that makes it consistent with a post-conviction transcript, there's no basis for that. The respondent can't ask this court to just trust what's in the trial transcript and not submit it to the court. There is sufficient evidence in the trial transcript and in the letters to demonstrate very clearly that Ms. Brown lied, that the state knowingly used this testimony to obtain Mr. Cheeks' conviction, and
those points were argued, were they not, though, to the district court, the discrepancy?
They were, and the district court afforded absolute deference to the state court's decision. It didn't look at the trial transcript. It looked at the...
Well, you told her what you thought were the major features that made it to show that there was a perjury, right?
Mr. Cheeks did, and the district court instead merely cited to the state court's record and, or excuse me, the state court's decision that said that the testimony was, quote, the same. The district court quoted that and then didn't look at all at the transcript. The U.S. Supreme Court in Millerell versus Cockrell said that is not enough. The district court has to dig in at least a little bit. I see that my time is up. I just would like to respectfully request that the court reverse or vacate the district court's denial of the petition for a writ of habeas corpus.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Mays, you also served by appointment of the court, and you have the deep thanks of the court for your very fine efforts on behalf of your client. And again, we thank your law firm for devoting time and resources to this matter. We thank both counsel in the case, indeed, and the case is now taken under advisement.